192/2 facts, you know, how to basically gauge a person's behaviour, the state of mind under different conditions, because as you're well aware that, you know, when we meet people in daily life, you know, we don't always know what we see. You know, people can present different faces, different aspects to them, but when you put them under different conditions, when you put them under, you know, when you put them with difficult people, when you put them with kind people, when you put them under stress, then you get a feel for where the person is at, because, you know, you're exploring many, say, parameters to the personality. All you guys had sheets? So that'll be Sutta 1. It'll, if you look at page 563 on the Anguttara Fours. Yeah, 563 page. And have any luck? Is it okay if I make a start? Or okay, so what I'll do is I'll just go over quite slowly, and then I'll just check you roughly every paragraph or two. And you know, if you've got any points or anything whatsoever, don't be shy. You can put it forward, and we'll bring it up for discussion. So, bhikkhus, four facts about people in general, and that includes everyone, both the monastics and the lay fraternity, regardless of, say, religious denominational culture. By dwelling together, their virtuous behavior can be known, and this only after a long time, not casually, by one who is attentive, not by one who is inattentive, and by one who is wise, not by one who is unwise. By dealing with them, their integrity can be known, and this only after a long time, not casually, by one who is attentive, not by one who is inattentive, by one who is wise, not by one who is unwise. So you're looking at the four categories here. In misfortune, their fortitude can be known. So in times of difficulty, and this only after a long time, not casually, by one who is attentive, not by one who is inattentive, and by one who is wise, not by one who is unwise. By conversation, their wisdom can be known, and this only after a long time, not casually, by one who is attentive, not by one who is inattentive, and by one who is wise, not by one who is unwise. So, you know, when you look at those four major categories so that we have this major principle, the virtuous behavior, integrity, fortitude, and wisdom. So with, say, a person's virtuous behavior, you can have, say, variations on a theme where a person can be, if you want to take, say, complete virtue, it's the kind of virtue which is, say, stable and predictable, virtually across almost any situation. I mean, people aren't foolproof. You can, tempt the devil, so to speak. And there was two of Ajahn Brahm's long-term disciples, and they were quite a nice couple. They'd been practicing Buddhist for a long, long time, and both of them were quite very, very good-looking people. And over the course of their marriage at that time, I think they'd been together for at least 20 years. They people would throw temptation their way and basically put their marriage to the test. So, with their marriage dynamics, they had to sort of adjust to this kind of behavior from other people over time, and they sort of developed this sort of sense of trust and understanding between them. So they wouldn't get into difficulty into, say, complicated relationships with other people, which could have potentially gone wrong. And that point too, their integrity. So actually, we'll leave that one to last. So misfortune. So essentially, with this aspect of misfortune, naturally, when we look at the course of our lives, we all have our ups and downs, our difficulties, and our small and large tests in life, but it's the way that the person, say, reacts to the circumstances they find themselves. Some people are very very sensitive to stress. Some people may find their inner resolve or determination gets affected. Things like a person has certain, say, goals in mind. I knew there was one gentleman who came upstairs who had saved for something like well over 10 years. Had organized his life, had saved about tens of thousands of dollars over 10 years in order to put himself through medical school. And there was some very unfortunate financial circumstances, and he just lost absolutely everything. I didn't go into detail with him, and then he felt that his life was just virtually meaningless. And the poor guy, he was on the edge. He wanted to kill himself, and so that was incredibly important to him. That was his life ambition, to become a medical doctor. There was a couple of people in this kind of category in different circumstances. So when you really, really put to the test and things don't go your way, things go wrong in a major way, how are we going to, how are we going to deal with this? Will we go under? Will we basically drown? Or will we, manage to keep our head above the water and keep going? And say this principle of conversation. So as we, in order to say understand the wisdom faculty of a person, and how do we know that a person is wise, or a person is pretentious, or a person is, say, highly intellectual, and you've got a combination of factors where you can have people who are fantastic talkers because they've got the supporting intelligence, they've got the vocabulary, they've got the communication skills, they've got the ability to, to be charming, interesting, engaging. You're looking at a number of, say, factors there which may be quite impressive. And it is, I mean, intelligence can give you a degree of insight and wisdom, because the mind is quite sharp. You know, it notices. The average, maybe a person who is functioning, you know, just a person with a very just dead average intelligence. The sensory awareness, the intellectual awareness, and the sharpness of the senses, the mind speed, and the memory power. It's not at the same level as someone who's you might consider to be, say, brilliant or like highly intelligent. And but you know, in conversation, you know, how when we talk about our life experience, the wisdom faculty will be that which has a very comprehensive understanding of what you go through. And some people may have a very, say, broad knowledge of a particular subject, and that knowledge base will give you a degree of understanding which will definitely be greater. You can draw on that knowledge, that information. You can assimilate and process that information in order to provide facts and detail, and you know, you can cross-reference. When you've got an incredibly large body of knowledge in a particular category, you may give people the impression that you have a very deep understanding of the topic, but it doesn't necessarily mean the case, because with the wisdom faculty, it's more in relation with your whole, say, life experience. It's not focused specifically in a particular category, a particular experiential or intellectual category. The wisdom faculty, it permeates many areas of your life, and you know, with the wisdom principle, it's wisdom in action. When you watch people very, very closely, the way they think, the way they walk, the way they talk, and you know what they do or say with the physical body on whatever level, that will give you an awareness of you know, how deep their understanding goes of, say, of themselves, of life, of other people, because the person who has genuine wisdom will move in a direction which correlates, like a degree of, say, like understanding. My father had a friend from Steelworks many, many years ago, and this gentleman had a virtually photographic memory, give it like absolute minimum 98-99% recall, incredibly very, very powerful memory. But his family dynamics, his mum was had chronic schizophrenia, and he was definitely, possibly because of the upbringing, but he was definitely on the edge there as well. He definitely had his behaviour was you wouldn't consider him. He was quite a reasonable human being in most circumstances, but his behaviour was quite strange. Possibly it could have been past karma, possibly genetics. You know, it's the way that, you know, if you've got a mother who's got schizophrenia, that increases your own potential for mental health issues. You know, could come from a number of directions, and so you, with that wisdom, you know, understanding that principle of cause and effect. So as you move through the course of your life, you know, you move in a certain direction, you make decisions, the way you engage people, the kind of motives you have, it's like a person who has a deeper understanding of life. They're more reflective, they're more careful, they think more carefully about what they do, and you know, when they do things. So the quality of intention, and people who, so this particular gentleman, he could have easily done an honors degree, I'd say easily a PhD, just based on memory power, this aspect of brain power, but he with his the personality wasn't completely balanced, and plus he did not want to go to university and basically follow to maybe because they were in the engineering fraternity at the Steelworks. He could have easily done mechanical, electrical engineering degrees, multiple degrees, but he didn't want to go to university and people with people who were very close to his own level. He found that quite threatening. And the course on the overall behaviour with the parental upbringing, it affects the emotional makeup, and his behaviour was there's no way I would have trusted him. Over time, my father, we had to basically cut him loose over time, because his behaviour was he was a bit funny with my mother. He was interested in my mother, so my father wasn't particularly thrilled about that. So it was said, by dwelling together, their virtuous behaviour can be known, and this only after a long time, not casually, by one who is attentive, not by one who is inattentive, by one who is wise, not by one who is unwise. On account of what was this said? Here, bhikkhus, by dwelling together with another person, one comes to know them thus. For a long time, this particular person's conduct has been broken, flawed, blemished, and blotched, and they do not consistently observe and follow virtuous behavior. This particular person is immoral, not virtuous. But in another case, by dwelling together with another person, one comes to know them thus. For a long time, this particular person's conduct has been unbroken, flawless, unblemished, and unblotched, and they consistently observe and follow virtuous behavior. This particular person is virtuous, not immoral. So it was on account of this that it was said, by dwelling together, their virtuous behavior can be known. And it's only after a long time, that would be at least several years, not casually, by one who is attentive, and not by one who is inattentive, and by one who is wise, not by one who is unwise. Has anyone got any opinions at all? You can throw anything into the hat, anything whatsoever. Yeah, so, you know, but one, so even say, for example, on this platform of moral behavior, say virtuous behavior, I mean, you know, we have words like, say, morality, sila, virtue, you know, but what does it actually mean? You know, as a baseline principle, it's an understanding and observance of the precepts that we have an obligation to follow voluntarily. And the reason why we follow the precepts voluntarily, because we see the value in a moral code of conduct. You know, people who, if I get the words right, people who are lacking in, like awareness, lacking in understanding, have no real, like appreciation, respect for morality in general. They won't be particularly concerned about sila, about maintaining sila, because they may feel that, you know, that being a goody-goody in the world will actually put you at a disadvantage, will maybe give people the opportunity to take advantage and rip you off. You know, you may miss out on, you know, if you possibly miss out on opportunities which come your way. But that's not necessarily the case, because, you know, from what I see, you know, people who are able to keep sila to the best of their ability tend to their life tends to be more smooth, stable, less problematic, less difficult, less interpersonal problems between themselves and others. And things come their way eventually, because when you accord with moral law, accord with moral law, which is connected to karma, one's karma that one is generating from moment to moment, that you essentially you keep yourself in line with this Dhamma principle, and even it's very very subtle, and you can watch, like pay attention in this category, and you just watch what happens. You look at people who are very, very loose with their morality, and you look what it's just you pay just watch them very, very closely, and you watch what happens to them over the years, and the quality of their life usually is not so fantastic. They tend to run into problems with other people. They tend to run into financial problems or difficulties, and all sorts of things can go wrong. Health issues, disease. Because what we do, it has an effect. So, whatever kind of energy that I project out into the world, that's going to come full circle and return to me at some point. But some people, because it's so subtle, they may find it hard to believe. And it's not until they just really get, really whacked big time, and that they get sort of the wake-up call. You know, people who are sensitive, intuitive, and they watch the dynamics. And like a practicing Buddhist will have an underlying awareness, even to a shallow degree, of the way Sila works and the way karma connects with Sila. You know, it's something that you feel, and your mind, your mind reflects that. You know, so for example, anyone who's been practicing minimum 5-10 years, if a person does something wrong, 90% of the time their mind will tell them, their underlying awareness, their intuition will indicate that they may have gone in the wrong direction, made an incorrect decision, maybe connected with the wrong person. So it's much more subtle. The average person walking the street, may not really. The training that we follow, time. So, further, it was said, by dealing with them, their integrity can be known, and this only after a long time, not casually, by one who is attentive, not by one who is inattentive, by one who is wise, not by one who is unwise, on account of what was this said. Here, bhikkhus, when dealing with a person, one comes to know them thus. This person deals with one person in one way, in another way if they deal with two, in still another way if they deal with three, in still another way if they deal with many. Their dealings in one case deviate from their dealings in another. This particular person is impure in their dealings with others, not pure in such dealings. But in another case, when dealing with a person, one comes to know them thus. In the same way as they deal with one, they deal with two, three, or many. Their dealings in one case do not deviate from their dealings with others, not impure. This, that it was said, by dealing with them, their integrity can be known, and this only after a long time, not casually, by one who is attentive, not by one who is inattentive, by one who is wise, not by one who is unwise. So, yep.
Concerning the awareness level, it makes it very difficult for the average person and for people in general normally to become aware in the first place, and then secondly to start becoming aware of, oh, that behaviour is okay, that one isn't okay. Or speech, whatever it might be. So therefore, even sitting here and listening to this, which I just love, by the way, thank you, it sometimes can be very challenging because they can't get what is being said because they can't grasp the concept of it. Would you agree with that one, or...?
Yeah, definitely, because, the Buddhist path is very much a feely-feely path, and it's an experiential, emotional, intuitive path. You know, we learn through our feelings, we learn through our senses, and the mind, you know, the mind experience, our emotional mind experience. So the average person, you know, so for example, if you get someone who's been practicing for 5 years, and especially when they meditate, you know, precepts are good, study and chanting are good, but, you know, if you, especially with the meditation, you correct it, you approach it in the right manner, and in order to get good results, that it can be very beneficial in the sense that it helps you, the person, be more well-rounded. It really helps to sharpen the awareness with the sila and sensory awareness. You know, a person notices things more than the average person, and they see more deeply into, say, the cause and effect. You know, if that person moves in a certain direction, or if I move in a certain direction, there's going to be certain, like a particular result, either good or bad. And so this principle of actually seeing more of the big picture. Maybe the average person walking the street may notice a little bit, maybe things like here and there, but especially the practitioners and the meditators, they can see so much more, because the Buddha's training, the way of practice of the Buddhist lifestyle, it's conducive to making a person more like well-rounded. You know, that you're looking, the Eightfold Path, you know, the Eightfold Path is a complete path. That's why there's eight factors, and you need eight factors in order to realize that profound, you know, the profound Dhamma of the Nibbana element, plus the associated insights which come when a person withdraws from the cessation of feeling perception. So you get deep insights into dependent origination, you know, the cause and effect principle, you know, potentially karma and rebirth, and there could be other deep insights connected when you immediately withdraw from, say, that deep enlightenment experience, the Nibbana experience. So that will, as you withdraw back to conscious awareness, and your faculties become active, and then those insights just arise just, you know, immediately after that point.
But, and that can be very fearful for some people.
Not necessarily. I heard one teacher say that after they realized the Sotapanna stage, that it was so, basically, it shook their world to a degree. But you got a person at that level has got a much greater degree of stability. Achan Cha made a comment that if an average person had the Arahant experience, the full enlightenment stage, if the average person had that, they would potentially completely lose their faculties. They would lose their mind. He didn't go into deep detail, but if you don't have the stability of mind and the underlying insight to support you, if they went through a full enlightenment experience, moved in from a normal state of consciousness, deep meditation, and they were able to fully purify the mind, you know, the words that he used, the person would completely lose their faculties, and other people might consider them to be, say, insane. But the words that he used were, you know, like the way he was looking at life was completely different. You know, I can only use sort of words to convey the meaning, but as people would look at life in general, he would look in a completely different format. And as people were walking in one direction, he was walking in another. And this particular more junior teacher said that in the Sotapanna first enlightenment stage, I mean, they which is not to be very deep attainment, even though it's the first of the four levels. You know, they say that, you know, you will never be the same again. Your mind just completely turns, and your mind is completely in line with Dhamma to like a very large degree. The Sotapanna level, it's not foolproof. It's there are potential. How am I going to explain it? There are potential things that you might see that you may feel not. Maybe if you're an idealistic person, you may feel that it's not completely straight and true, but the individual concerned, they're operating on a higher level. So it's very hard to understand the intentions. Really understand the this kind of big picture that they're looking at, as far as the kind of decisions they make, the direction they move. You know, there's but they the boundaries are very, very firm. You know, there are certain things they just will not do. You won't say with a person at the solar panel level, you won't see them do anything like really sleazy, tricky, underhanded, deceptive. They can have slips in memory. They can have slight impairments of in judgment, but the mind is very, very straight. Really, like, you know, they've got this kind of corridor mentality. They know which way they are going, and they won't be distracted. They know the Eightfold Path. They know the way to Nibbana. They know the supporting conditions, and they essentially, their life revolves around that principle. It revolves around Dhamma, and it revolves around the establishment of the teaching, and you know, other associated principles. But people who are operating at a lower level, choice of wrong words, they can't get the full. Until they've had that experience, they can't relate to that person at the level that they're at. You can't, the average monk and nun can't possibly understand the mind of a sotapanna. It's just impossible. You can observe them and watch them, and you can watch the direction that they move, but the way they move, the way they think, and the way they do things, they're operating at a higher level. And even if you don't particularly agree, their principles are in relation with the path. You know, they don't deviate from the path. It's not like worldly fame. You know, there's a massive, you know, like incredibly fat bank account, stuff like that. It's all the stuff that they do, and the people they connect with, and this and that is connected with the development of the path and teaching people. And it doesn't move outside that fraternity. It doesn't move in a worldly perspective, any kind of like corrupt, it's in line with the Dhamma principle. So further it was said, in misfortune their fortitude can be known, and this only after a long time, not casually, by one who was attentive, not by one who was inattentive, by one who was wise, not by one who was unwise. On account of what was this said? Because someone is afflicted with the loss of relatives, wealth, or health, but they do not reflect thus. Human life in the world is of such a nature that the eight worldly conditions revolve around the world, and the world revolves around these eight worldly conditions, namely gain and loss, disrepute and fame, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. Thus, when afflicted with loss of relatives, wealth, or health, they sorrow, languish, and lament. They weep, beating their breast, and become confused. But in another case, someone who is afflicted with the loss of relatives, wealth, or health, but does not reflect thus, human life in the world is such that the eight worldly conditions revolve. But this person does reflect us. Human life in the world is such that the eight worldly conditions revolve around the world. The world revolves around these eight worldly conditions, namely gain and loss, disrepute and fame, blame and praise, pleasure and pain. Thus, when afflicted with the loss of relatives, wealth, or health, they do not sorrow, languish, and lament. They do not weep, beating their breast, and become confused. It was on account of this that it was said thus. In misfortune, their fortitude can be known, and this only after a long time, not casually, by one who is attentive, not by one who is inattentive, by one who is wise, not by one who is unwise. Is there any opinions on that at all? In misfortune? No. Yeah, just I've got my reading glasses on, so I can barely see. Not to be affected. Yeah, I mean that's the normal human experience, is to have ups and downs and you know, our good days and bad days and whatnot. But it does, you know, when life gets difficult, or when things go wrong in different ways, that you'll be able to see the understanding and the stability of the person, say emotional stability, to a degree. You know, people, like for example, if you put somebody under pressure in different ways and they completely fall apart, or you know, there's major life tragedies and they just completely lose the plot, which may be understandable. You know, say for example, if you lost your whole family, you know, that would be incredible blow for most people, to lose parents, you know, brothers and sisters in one hit. And but that will essentially show just how strong the mind is, and it will demonstrate just the level of, say, like insight and understanding to a degree. It doesn't necessarily, you know, say for example, it's the same thing again. People at the enlightenment stages, even at the Sotapanna level, even if you lost your whole family in a car accident or an aeroplane crash, there would be a sense of loss and sorrow to a small degree, but they would not get blown away. I mean, at all. They wouldn't be, you know, even if you spoke to them like maybe even a week later, you know, that person would be in emotionally, psychologically would be in, like, they'd be in good shape. But you know, with people, you know, for the average monastic lay disciple, you know, we can be quite sensitive depending on what's actually happening. Us, because some things will affect others, things will affect some people much more than others. But you know, that principle, you know, you're looking at extremes. But you know, say for example, I did a funeral several days ago with there was a Japanese lady, her and Western husband, and that was the first time her son. That's the first time I've actually seen a man behind the microphone. Doing his oration for his mother. He was expressing some poems and some sentiments, and the tears were just rolling, you know, down his cheeks, and he was breaking up. And that's the first time I've seen a guy just cry so profusely. And I've probably done at least 20 funerals or so, but I think he must have been very, very close to his mother, and she was a very, very good person, and very caring, loving, supportive, and a practicing Buddhist for many, many years. Unfortunately, she developed dementia, and then she eventually passed away. But you know, if somebody doesn't, you know, when at the funeral, if a person feels nothing, say they lose mum or dad or a brother or sister, and they feel nothing, we may consider that to be like a bit of an aberration. That person's not normal. They don't have normal human feelings. We expect people to feel that sense of sorrow and loss, you know, grief and pain. You know, we feel that's a normal way. That's a normal way for a healthy human being to respond, because if they don't hardly feel anything at all, it's like psychologically it's like an aberration. It's I wouldn't mind looking at that sutra again. If you remember, I'll have to word search it. But I haven't read over that one for many years. Yeah, with the. Neighbouring clan. Yeah, I'll check that one again. It's been a long time. But for the arahant, and especially a person at such an incredibly high level, you know, and the Buddhas are the most highly developed beings in the universe. That if one saw the Buddha, you know, he could be quietly reflecting on this incredible tragedy, what happened, but it is. That reflection is based in deep insight and understanding, because the Buddha could understand the karma, the complete karma of other people. You know, just like that. You know, he could size every single person up, and he knew exactly the reasons why that person's life was taken and the circumstances. And even the two chief disciples, Moggallana Sariputta, didn't have that ability to go right back into a person's past lives and know exactly what it was, why his family, why they lost their land, their lives in that particular major conflict. So when as he's looking at this particular situation, he is looking at it through the lens of deep insight, not through the lens of emotional sentiment. And because arahants don't feel, they don't feel like emotions like grief and sorrow and separation and loss. They don't feel those things. The mind is completely equanimous but the understanding is there. You know, like understanding like karma, cause and effect, intention and just exactly how the mind works and how feelings work. They understand the full process, but they're not caught up and entangled in the experience, because the mind, the mind's completely purified of all underlying say defilements, emotions, you know, the personality view, so they don't identify with anything. It's just very pure still mind which understands the deep nature of what actually has happened. Yep.
Yeah, I guess I'm struggling a little bit with this one in the sense that someone, as you're describing, who has deep insight, may look almost the same as someone who is actually repressing their emotional experience and actually doesn't actually. So they may actually look the same from the outside, but they're actually in very different places. Like someone could be not crying, say, when their whole family was killed, but that may be coming from actually repressing their emotional experience, not because they have deep insight.
That could certainly be true. But once you got to know that person, you could size them up over time.
So that's where the time comes.
A complete stranger, we may, you know, say for example you've got a person who's quite cool, made some major tragedy, and the person was emotionally quite cool and balanced and stable, and we might think that's quite, you know, quite unusual, but you know you would get, you know, if you got to know them better, you'd probably be able to size them up, and over time you'd have a reasonably good idea where they were at, you know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, just in that, say, like, for example, a thought which came up in my mind is this business with, say, sociopaths and potentially psychopaths. They don't have a normal human experience. Like, you know, Chris would understand this very well, but, you know, we all of us here have this a degree of, say, sensitivity and awareness, the way, you know, the way we affect people, our relationships with other people. But these people... you know, they don't feel the same way that we do. There may be like a similar thought pattern where they want certain things in life. They want to be successful, or they want certain things for themselves. But their normal sort of the normal behavior, like the emotional pattern, it's not the same as the so-called the general population. I've never studied this to any great degree, but I saw a documentary and they were talking about the mind experience of a sociopath, and the emotionally they don't seem to care. They don't have a sense of real kindness or compassion or an emotional sensitivity or sentiment with other people. They can use other people quite ruthlessly, quite uncaringly. The kind of human, the normal human responses that we experience, they don't seem to have that. But it could come from maybe bad, very very poor parenting. It could even be things like brain tissue damage. I mean, Chris would probably know the full spectrum of.
Great insight, who also wouldn't be expressing the emotion, but that's because they actually, like a sotapanna or someone has such deep insight that they're feeling it, but it's not, as Chris was saying, personalised, which is,
yeah. A thought came up in my mind that there was this particular gentleman, they were doing a number of case studies, and this particular gentleman had actually witnessed the it was on television. He'd witnessed the bombing of the Twin Towers, and he couldn't. This is a turning point for him. He couldn't really understand why. He could only see his own perspective. He was completely unaffected by the bombing of the Twin Towers in America, and he couldn't. He just couldn't relate to the way that these people felt, because it was like in his own mind he was completely unaffected, and he couldn't connect with how the people who were actually on right there, or their families, he couldn't really connect with them on a emotional level. He said things like this particular lady was interested in him, and he was prepared to marry her, But he said even during the ceremony, he said, like his words were, he said I'll go to your marriage. He said, I'll go through the motions, but he said, if I see it's made there, I can't guarantee what will happen. So it's like this emotional disconnect. They just don't seem to care so much. There's probably a lot more to it. The sensitivity and the care and the kind of human responses that we expect just don't seem to be there. But he realized when he went through that, you know, things were happening through the course of his life, and he knew he was different to other people. But with that thing with the Twin Towers, when he felt absolutely nothing, because he was at a distance, he was in another city, felt absolutely nothing for the suffering and the pain. Incredible number of people who died. Then he went to see a professional psychiatrist, and he realized there was he wasn't like other people. His responses were not considered normal. So, further it was said, by conversation their wisdom can be known, and this only after a long time, not casually, by one who was attentive, not by one who was inattentive, by one who was wise, not by one who was unwise, on account of what was this said. Here, because when conversing with someone, one comes to know, judging from the way this person initiates, formulates, and poses a question, they are unwise, not wise. For what reason? The venerable, the person does not speak about matters that are deep, peaceful, sublime, beyond the sphere of reasoning, or may say beyond the sphere of thinking, subtle, comprehensible to the wise, which will be like based in experience. When this person speaks on the Dhamma, they are not able to explain, teach, describe, establish, reveal, analyze, and explicate its meaning, either briefly or in detail. This person is unwise, not wise, just as if a man with good sight standing on the banks of a pond were to see a small fish emerging. They would think, judging from the way this fish emerges, from the ripples it makes, and from its force, this is a small fish, not a big one. So too, when conversing with a person, one comes to know, judging from the way this person initiates, formulates, and poses a question, they are unwise, not wise. So, but in another case, when conversing with someone, one comes to know, judging from the way the person initiates, formulates, and poses a question, they are wise, not unwise. For what reason? The person speaks about matters that are deep, peaceful, sublime, beyond the sphere of reasoning, subtle, comprehensible to the wise. When the person speaks on the Dhamma, they are able to explain, teach, describe, establish, reveal, analyze, and explicate its meaning, both briefly and in detail. The person is wise, not unwise, just as if a man with good eyesight standing on the banks of a pond were to see a big fish emerging. They would think, judging from the way the fish emerges, from the ripple it makes, from its force, this is a big fish, not a small one. So too, when conversing with someone, one comes to know, judging from the way this person initiates, formulates, and poses a question, they are unwise, not unwise. So, was there any opinions on that one? Engaging people in conversation, one can see if a person has insight or not. You can give any opinion whatsoever. But what if I evaluate the people around me, but I'm still quite deluded?
Thank you.
Would you say if a person, I mean, there's a parameter there, but would you say that a person can have mood swings, but through the power of intelligence, they could still assess another person clearly? If the intellect was very, very powerful, even though they, it all depends what kind of category. You can have people who have mania, and you could have a person who's incredibly intelligent who has mania, so they're running high and with all the associated features of that condition, but they're also highly intelligent. And As you were talking, that this principle of the personality, so like for example, the person who sees through the personality view, and they realize that at a very profound level that the personality is essentially a conditioned phenomena, is an empty, impersonal phenomena, and from that point, then they move towards. Say like the development of right view, where they see things far more accurately, like unbiased, with less preference. In reality, only really the arahant would be free from any kind of sort of say like deluded perception when they assess what's actually going on. Around it, but it's only when the person, say at the first level, the first enlightenment stage, when one sees through one eliminates personality view, then one has the ability to develop the right view as far as not only the path, but the dynamics around one, because that one's mind is less affected and disturbed by the underlying defilements. In the mind, and one has more clarity. Essentially, they're like at the Buddha in a genuine temporary emptiness. So you have this temp emptiness until you get the emptiness of really valuable. I mean, even in 20, very very easily, and because it's not because it's like a genuine mind experience. But you know, people who are very practicing, you know, the path feel this great sense of social commitment. They want to help support. It could be like they you know, samadhi, because they spoke and this and that, because he couldn't find him process, and Ajahn Brahm was convinced that he had the third jhana, but he was actually functioning as a village monk, as a school teacher, teaching the children, and he was engaged in some community support programs, and he was much more engaged than, say, the forest monks would be in general. But he also had incredible meditation by comparison. You know, so it's like he could have potentially been a person who had at least absolute minimum, probably two or three lifetimes under his belt, you know, spiritual development, and his faculties were very, very strong across the range. The meditation was strong, but the Brahma Viharas and possibly his insight. So he was quite well developed. His faculties as a human being were quite well developed, and he was able to hold his practice together, but also engage in the local community and help others. But it's funny though, because when you look at the each person will have their own take on it to a degree. There's factors there which are the underlying factors are solid. You know, they're very very similar from one person to a next. You know, when you're talking about mind experience, it's very much the same from a person to another. Slight variation in kind of like energy and things which might come up. But lost my train of thought. I lost it. When we say, for example, the person goes into the jhana state, there is a degree of psychological protection there, to at least a small degree, because the individual, they have to let go of everything that you see in this world, and so you're looking at this very say deep state of psychological relaxation and emotional letting go to all one's attachments. So as a person goes, if they don't like freeze or become fearful, they can actually move into that state without major. If it's a smooth transition, go into that state without any, say, fear or emotional trauma whatsoever, because that will essentially block them. As soon as I freeze, as soon as I get scared, I get worried, or this type of thing, is essentially going to stop me. So the person, if it's a genuine state, they go in, and there's no. No real obstacles. There's nothing which basically hinders them. The Buddha talked about the five hindrances. So the words I would use is the person is unhindered going in, And there's essentially, if it's a smooth, you go into the state in a smooth, it's like a smooth transition going into the jhana state. There's essentially nothing there to basically shake you up. So you just go deeper, deeper, deeper into stillness until the mind unifies. But naturally, you know, some people, they may get a shock and they end up, you know, they can only go so far and then they come back to sensory awareness. And that's like it's like the test in a way. You have to let go. To get into a jhana state, you've got to let go of everything in this world, you know, for it could be 5 minutes, 10 minutes, or even several hours, depending on the level of like mental energy. Was any particular reason with it? What are the dynamics behind it? To sabotage fear. And they feel that would block people from very, very deep meditation, potentially? Or?
Remember that story that Ajahn Mun talks about the nun that was on the verge of jhana, and she was describing her experience, and then why didn't you just let go? That is just so cool.
Yeah. One of the forest masters, he was talking about the development of the path, and he was saying that when it came to our worldly experience, this is just a thought which came up. It might be a slight deviation, but he said there with the, he was just talking about the realization of the path, and he said if there was anything. What would you call it? Say with the male female energy. If there was a second principle of at that level, he said the vast majority of people, they would not be able to attain to the path because it would just be like too difficult. So essentially. It was just a thought which came up. It's a little bit of a sidetrack, but he said if there was a force at the same level, a second force at the same level as the male female sexual energy, sexual attraction, he said the vast majority of people would not realize the path because it's just too difficult, the obstructions. No other points anyone wanted to add?
I was just thinking, is the whole point of this sutta to explain how we can discriminate between companions, possibly, who are wise or not wise, as well as teachers, and to just seek to be near people who are wise and to give away
being near people who are not wise.
Yeah, it can be. So, but the thing is, you may, we can't always pick and choose the people that we associate with, the people that we work with, and sometimes, you can learn a lot from someone who's quite deluded or quite difficult, and even in Thailand, they do things like that. They put you in a monastery, or they put you with people that you're forced to get along with. You have to adjust and watch over one's own behavior, because some teachers, they have this idea that if you have certain aspects of your character which aren't challenged or shaken up, that you won't be able to understand yourself well enough to actually get past that thing. If I have a problem with anger, if I'm in a normal state of awareness, the vast majority of people that I associate with, they're very pleasant people, quite kind people. But I don't think I've ever had someone basically. I had my father flipped at me the second last time I was home, and he was shouting in my face, and he misperceived me. He thought I was insulting my mother. And he was shouting, we were in the backyard, and he was shouting in my face and calling me an asshole, and just going on and on. And I didn't get particularly angry, but it's like, when you have people in a normal state of awareness, we can be peaceful and kind and reasonably tolerant and this and that, until you really put that person under pressure or put the screws on, and then they may unfortunately become aware. I wouldn't say unfortunately, it might be an opportunity for them. Then you just see just how much anger or maybe impatience one has. It's not something I do with other people. I don't play games with other people, but somebody did that to me in the monastery, and they just kept pushing me and pushing me and pushing me and pushing me and pushing me over a couple of weeks. And in the end, I because it's a tricky situation, you basically can't punch other monks in the face, in the monastery. So I just asked him, nicely to stop. He just went completely over the top. Asked him nicely to stop harassing and pushing me, and he took it on board, and that was the end of it. But I, unfortunately, because I didn't understand his background, I was only just joking, teasing like a little, but unfortunately, because I didn't realize his family background completely, his culture and whatnot, I made him really angry. And as I was joking and teasing, I thought we had an understanding, because I didn't go too far. I didn't put a hand on him. It was just friendly, sociable type of engagement. I do this with other monks, and there's no problem at all. But different culture, highly intelligent, but like insecure, and unfortunately, I made him very, very angry, and so he turned around. And he just kept pushing me, and I want you to, his perspective was, I want you to feel, I'm going to do to you what you did to me. But I didn't basically blow my top or spin out. I certainly felt it. He was really starting to annoy me, but it wasn't full-blown anger, but he really, really started to annoy me. But he wanted me to really feel it. He wanted to push me as far as he could within the rules. So I would get a sense for what he was going through. So and I thought from that point, I thought, yeah, that's it. So I with that individual, I just backed right off and I just left them alone. I didn't speak to them for months, and I thought, you just got to be so careful. We're not inside we just can't see inside other people's minds. We don't know their family, unless they actually speak to us about it. We don't know their family background, the way their father treated them, and all these other kind of dynamics. So it's very, even for monks, I've been in community for 23 years, and I wasn't until he reacted, I just didn't realize how I was affecting him on the personal level. It was all family stuff. It wasn't me so much, but it was connected with the father. So, shall we call it? Is there any more?
Anger. Thank you.
Sorry, say again then.
It's not like you make someone angry. It's just that sometimes you press a button in there that you didn't know, you know, of their background or something. So it's within that person that anger arises. You might be sort of an agent for that, but you don't actually make them angry.
Well,
they make themselves angry, don't they? You
may have no intention at all to upset them, but they completely misperceive you.
So that was right intention. It's not wrong intention. So you haven't actually made them angry. They have anger within themselves, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the potential was there inside them, but the bottom line is that you've got to live with that individual, and you know you see them, you know, you can't avoid them. That at breakfast, lunch, bathroom. You know, you know, even though the property is 100 acres, you know, you can't get away from them at all. And it's just amazing. Some of the things which go on between the monks, the way they trigger each other.
But we just don't know the backgrounds of other people, do we? I think that's why families are so compassionate, because we all know through families what family goes through, like, you know, more intimate sisters and brothers and that sort of thing. You don't know where other people come from. I can barely hear you. So we have compassion in families because we know the background and what's happened to those people in the families. But other people that you meet in social situations, you actually don't know where they come from. So you might just make a mistake and push a button that you didn't intend to do, isn't it?
Yeah. Most of the monks, probably easily 50% of the monks connect quite well with this kind of, like, sort of jokey, teasy kind of approach, because it helps to relax people. But some cultures, they don't do that at all. You know, so.
But I mean, he might have had like a really bullying father or something, you know, and that pressed the button in him. Anyway.
Ajahn Api. Interesting was being discussed, you know. You find that a lot of times, you know, if you feel that if you are joking with people, okay, you don't mean to harm them, and they take it seriously, the other person has a problem, not you. He'll be reacting to other people the same way too. That's what I find.
Yeah, you can think. Yeah. You may think. I mean, it might be true that they've got an underlying problem, but the bottom line is that you know, you have to live with these guys, so you don't intentionally do things which upset them.
Mm.
But it's like community life. Mm. It just goes on. It happens all the time.
Yeah.
There's always somebody.
Yes, that's right.
There's always at least two or three guys.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Who've got something going at any time? Because I'm a bit further up the line. That they tell me about it, and but it's like, you know, it's just this whole thing. It forces you to learn and adapt, and the way you relate with people. Like I don't treat when I'm in the monastery. I don't treat people the same.
Mm-hmm.
I treat people in a way which is more or less necessary for. Good relations, most people, like, I've got this kind of, I'm a little bit on the like Thai style. I like to sort of joke around and tease and just play around just a little bit, but you know, you can only do that with some people and not others.
That's right. I see what you mean.
You know, it's like every person that comes your way, you may adjust your behavior just slightly in order to. To gel and to get along and to chat. You know, you watch yourself when you engage different people, and you'll just slightly adjust your behaviour to ingratiate is not the right word, but to engage and good communication, good personal relationships.
Mm. It happens to me too, because I like to joke, you know. But sometimes with different people, they take differently this thing. So what you have to do is just draw back this thing and you can't do anything then.
Yeah.
They are like that. Yeah. Mm. Oh yes, fair enough. Right time for that too, fair enough. This, okay, yeah.
Yeah, very good point. Okay, shall we call it a day?